Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Will Rogers once said, "I don't make jokes. I just watch the government and then report the facts." For many citizens, what is or is not happening in Washington is no laughing matter. They are fed up with government and the inability of Democrats and Republicans to get things done. Joining me in the studio to talk about what Americans think of Congress and the partisan politics in Washington today, American University professor James Thurber, Charlie Cook, the Cook Political Report, the Washington Post, Chris Saliza, and Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning, everybody.
Morning. Morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And Andy Kohut, give us a sense of just how upset people are with government.
These statistics speak for themselves. 15% of the American public approve of the job that Congress is doing. 80% say they're either angry or bothered by gridlock. 60% say the Republicans are doing a poor job of offering solutions to the country, and 50% say that about Democrats. People are very, very upset about things not getting done because their expectations were so high after the 2008 election. Most Republicans said they wanted their leaders to compromise a bit with Obama, and most Democrats said they wanted Obama to compromise a bit with the Republicans, and people don't see that.
Jim Thurber, is this something really big and different historically?
Well, Congress is always sort of in the cellar in terms of valuations. It's different, I think, at this point. I think the Americans have had it with partisanship, lack of comity and civility. They want things to get done. They want to compromise, as was pointed out. I think people are getting upset with the filibuster. And maybe it's time to look at the filibuster again. Filibuster takes a vote of 60 votes to stop a filibuster. And I think a lot of people think the Senate is the problem, not the House of Representatives at this point.
Chris Saliza, you had Obama defeat McCain by 9 million votes. So why can't he get things done?
365 electoral votes, Diane, as well, and a Senate that was at that time 60 votes strong with Democrats, 258 Democrats in the House, the largest majority certainly for a Democratic president in quite some time. Why couldn't he get things done? I think let's talk about healthcare specifically, because I think that's the biggest thing he hasn't been able to get done. I think part of the problem was every presidency is haunted, influenced in some ways by the presidencies that have gone before. Bill Clinton tried to reform health care. It was seen as that it was kept too private, that it was his wife, First Lady Hillary Clinton, running it with closed-door meetings. Congress was not involved. They eventually unveiled the plan to Congress, and Congress said, we don't like the plan. I think the President Obama went to the other end of the spectrum. He said, Congress, why don't you work your – I'm not going to tell you what I want. I want you to work your will. And let's move this thing forward. Well, the problem is there are a lot of people in Congress who have, including many Democrats, who want different things out of a bill, who represent very different states, who have different interests, different ideas of what should happen. And the bill wound up getting weighted down by all of these different ideas. That said, if Scott Brown doesn't win a special election in the most Democratic state in the country on January 19th, this isn't a problem, and healthcare has passed.
And Charlie Cook, looking ahead, how do you think this sort of heads toward November and the midterm elections?
Well, I think if you think about it, Democrats had a majority for 40 years until 1994, and through thick and thin, voters had patience and tolerance and general confidence in the institution, more or less. And then Democrats lost it in 1994. Then 12 years, you had Republicans in control, but then they had their scandals, they had their problems, they had their unpopular president, and then they get tossed out in 2006. I think right now we're on a trajectory towards Democrats losing the House. I mean, I think that we are headed to that point, that the macro, the diagnostic indicators in terms of polling we look at, in terms of the shifting of seats in our model, you know, we had 3 months ago, we were saying 15 to 25 seats. Then 2 months ago, we were saying 20 to 30. Now we're saying 30 to 35. You know, it's pretty easy to see where this trajectory is going and where voters just don't have patience anymore.
Charlie Cook, the Cook Political Report. Chris Saliza, author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, James Thurberry. He's professor and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University, and Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Chris Saliza, considering the current dissatisfaction, as Andy has pointed out, with both parties, has the GOP made the right decision to oppose everything on the president's agenda? You've talked about health care, but it's not only health care.
You know, I don't think we'll know if they made the right decision, Diane, until Election Day. Those are always the sort of the critical moments in any sort of the way in which these things play out. That said, I refer back to the Washington Post ABC poll that came out a little bit earlier this month. What it showed was Republicans narrowing – this is to Charlie's point – Republicans narrowing the trust gap, my phrase, with the president. That is on things like health care, the economy, domestic policy issues. People saying they still trusted the president more to handle these issues than Republicans, but that gap narrowing significantly than what we saw last year. Have Republicans done all that much to earn that trust? Not really. What they've been is the very loyal opposition. They're benefiting, I think, from the fact that people do not love the idea of Democrats being in charge of everything, and Republicans happen to be the other guy in that scenario.
Andy.
Yeah, well, to Charlie's point and to Chris's analysis here, anti-incumbent sentiment is at one of the highest points that we've measured in 16 years. It's comparable to the measures we had got at certain points in 2006 and in 94. However, I'm not so certain that the signs are that this will translate into a massive vote for Republicans for a couple of reasons. One, attitudes toward the opposing party, the Republicans, haven't yet become positive enough. There's not a dominant – Republicans don't dominate the Democrats on most of the image issues that we test on. Secondly, Obama's approval ratings have remained – they're not great, but they remain reasonably high. And if they remain reasonably high, they will be unlike Bush's awful ratings in 2006 and better than – Clinton's ratings for much of 1994. So I think that Charlie well could be right, but I don't think that that story's been finally written yet.
Charlie.
See, I think that midterm elections are binary, 0-1, and that it's a referendum on the party in power. And so I would agree with the premise that Republicans haven't offered much, haven't said much, don't have a charismatic leader, don't have a clear positive message. I would agree with all that, but it's not about them. I mean, this is an election about Democrats. Democrats have control of everything. People are extremely unhappy. They're frustrated. They don't like the face of the Democratic Party in Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid. They don't like anything they see about the Democratic Party in Congress. And we've seen – I mean, it took Republicans 8 years to destroy their brand. It took Democrats just one.
However, local issues will play, as you well know, and – you have to look at recruitment in the Republican Party. Will they have a litmus test for people that are really very conservative and do not reflect the views of the district, as happened in New York recently? Where's the money going? They're getting more money now. Maybe the Democrats get a lot more money. Will they drive to ideological purity and have more constraint on the party? That was the big battle in Honolulu.
What do you mean there, Jim?
Well, I mean, in Honolulu, they had a a debate over whether candidates had to sign a document that was very conservative in terms of what they believed in order to be a candidate. If they keep driving in that direction and the Tea Party people have an influence on their recruitment, Charlie, you may.
And what was the outcome in Hawaii, though? What was the outcome?
Well, they had
the establishment, the moderates won.
Yeah. Well, not totally. They had about eight of the items on the list that they had to sign. So that's at the national level. But locally, these Tea Party people may have an influence on recruitment.
Diane, just one point. Obviously, I work in the interest of full disclosure. Charlie gave me my first job in Washington, so I'm biased in his direction. Correct, right? Exactly. He paid my salary for many years.
Okay.
That said, I do think that I guess I would tend more with Charlie's point of view, and I'll give you one name, which is why I think that's the case: Mike Flanagan. Elected, beat Dan Rostenkowski, who most of your viewers know, a legendary Democrat. Now, there were other problems, there were ethics issues, but the point is he won in a district that was overwhelmingly Democratic because he was the other guy. He wasn't Dan Rostenkowski. We saw that happen in a number of places in 1994, many of which those seats went then back to Democrats, including Dan Rostenkowski's seat, which gave us someone named Rod Blagojevich eventually, who won that seat. So I do think that the point is that sometimes just being the other guy is enough if the national wind is blowing strong enough. I think if it's not, then absolutely these things will be decided in local issues. But we do have evidence in the somewhat recent past of national issues, the idea of a national referendum, overwhelming local issues, even overwhelming candidate quality, overwhelming fundraising, etc.
Chris is the author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. And when we come back, we're going to go back to those Senate rules that Jim Thurber talked about and take your calls. Stay with us. And when we opened this conversation, Professor Thurber was talking about the possibility of a change in Senate rules. Joining us now is Democrat Tom Udall. He's the junior senator from New Mexico. He serves on the Commerce, Environment, Indian Affairs, and Rules and Administration Committees. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Great to be with you this morning. Pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. Talk about the rules resolution you've introduced.
Well, I've introduced a very simple rules resolution that's been referred to the Rules Committee. And what it asserts is that under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, each house, meaning the Senate or the House of Representatives, may determine the rules of its proceedings, and that's by a majority vote. So basically, my resolution and the motion I will offer at the beginning of the 112th Congress will move us to a situation where the Senate takes responsibility for its rules, votes by a majority vote to adopt the rules of the 112th Congress.
Help me to understand what that would mean for future bodies of the House and the Senate. Would that mean that each time you had a two-year election since the Senate rotates a third of its body to be elected every 2 years. Would that mean that every 2 years the House and the Senate would vote on its own rules?
Yes, it would. That is the simplest way to say it. With every 2 years, both the House and the Senate take responsibility for the rules that they are going to function under that particular Congress, that two-year Congress. Now, that doesn't mean that the rules necessarily are not changed or modified in some way, or that you can't adopt the rules that you had in the last Congress. Frequently in the House, as you know, I served five terms in the House, and the first thing we would do at the beginning of every year would be to adopt the rules for the House of Representatives. Many times those were changed in just very minor ways. This is unlike the Senate. The Senate has rules today, and in particular Rule 22, the filibuster rule, where 97 of us have not voted. 97 members of the Senate have not voted on the rule that governs our major way of doing business today.
So that goes back to 1975. So you've got only Senators Byrd, Inouye, and Leahy, the three who did vote back then and whose rules still hold now.
That's right. So three senators voted for the rules, 97 haven't. I think it's a much healthier situation to have all senators involved in developing rules for the particular Congress that you're in. And so I've started a dialogue here with my resolution. I'm going to press for a hearing in the Rules Committee. I hope that we can bring Republicans and Democrats together around the idea that the rules are not working for us now. They're not working for the American people. They're not letting us assert the bold agenda that we should be pushing for the American people,
and
that was reflected in the last election.
And how much support do you think you have right now?
Well, I would say that there are several reform movements going on. Approximately five or six senators have already signed on to something similar, either my resolution or a resolution that Senator Harkin has put in. And then there's another tier that in informal conversations, I would say anywhere from six to eight senators who are expressing a great deal of interest in learning more, wanting to participate in a dialogue, maybe participate in a discussion as to what changes would be made in the rules and how could we function better as a body to reflect what the American people sent us here to do.
All right. I want to bring Jim Thurber in on this. Is the filibuster or the threat thereof, why is it such a roadblock to getting things done in Congress?
Well, as a few facts here, you need a cloture vote of 60 votes, just to make sure everyone knows, in order to proceed in the Senate and get over the filibuster. We've had more filibusters, threats of filibusters in the last few years. It's blocking some major legislation, and so a lot of people, especially the House members, are Democrats are very upset with the Senate on this, and some citizens are also. By the way, in 1975, I was working in the Senate at that time for Senator Hubert Humphrey, and if you look at it, it took about 15 years to go from 67 votes to 60 votes on this thing. And it takes a two-thirds vote to change the rules in the Senate, so it'll take a two-thirds vote, in my opinion, to go to a majority vote for the rules. Another fact, there are continuing rules in the Senate. Because only a third of the Senate is up for re-election, they will continue no matter what. And yes, you can vote any time you want to change those rules if you have two-thirds vote at the beginning of each Congress. Is it going to happen? No, I don't think it's going to happen.
Do you think that Tom Udall's effort is going to have any kind of an impact, whether it's this term or next term?
I think it's healthy to have deliberation and discussion over this so that Americans understand what's going on with the supermajority, and I think he's doing the right thing to go forward, but unfortunately for him, I don't think the votes are there quite yet.
Charlie Cook.
Yeah, I don't think this thing's going anywhere. The thing is, if the founding fathers had wanted two House of Representatives, they would have created two House of Representatives. And the Senate was created with certain dynamics, certain traditions, certain sets of rules in mind, and that's the way it is. To me, the problem isn't so much filibusters, it's the threat of filibusters. And, the filibuster wasn't that big a problem in the old days. But in the old days, there was this, if you threatened a filibuster, you had to be prepared to filibuster. And I think it's time to say, okay, you want to filibuster? How big's your bladder?
Yeah.
How long can you talk?
Yeah.
Right. How much stamina do you have? And let them go. Let them rip. But to me, the bigger problem is holds. I think that's where the better, more abuse is.
Senator Shelby.
The senators,
Alabama.
Putting a hold. I mean, a hold was, I think, originally designed to, there's a nomination coming up, and I've got a funeral tomorrow. Can you hold it till next week? You know, something like that. Instead of just one senator grinding everything to a halt anonymously, oftentimes. That's ridiculous. They ought to get rid of that.
Chris.
You know, I agree 100% with Charlie. The one thing I've been fascinated by over the last week and a half or so is the president has started to talk more sort of overtly in campaign rhetoric as we move towards 2010. One of the things that he speaks about regularly is the filibuster. He notes that in the 1950s and 60s, there were not as many filibuster votes or cloture votes as there were in 2009. That it's an impediment, that Republicans are in the way of getting things done. I don't know if that kind of process, Senate, legislative, parliamentary procedure argument works, but it would suggest, given the emphasis the president has given it in his recent speeches, he and the White House believe that it will and that they're going to move on this to put the lack of movement on these major issues on Republicans.
Chris, he's got a long way to go. Most Americans know about gridlock and lack of bipartisanship, but very few in our tests find very few people knowing about the 60 vote closure.
So, Senator.
Well, I would say, that Tom Udall here, is this recent New York Times poll where we've just had a couple of weeks of exposure of the president talking about the delay and in terms of the filibuster. And a majority of the public, I believe, in that poll said that they were willing to do away with the filibuster so that people could get to the merits of what the Senate is doing. So the point I would make is some of your earlier comments there on the Constitution does not mention anything about continuing rules. The only thing the Constitution says in Article 1, Section 5 is that each House, meaning both the Senate and the House of Representatives, may be, determine the rules of its proceedings. If you go back historically, the Senate, the early Senate, had a majority vote to terminate debate. It was called a motion to order the previous question. It's the motion that's used in the House of Representatives today. It wasn't until 1917 that an actual filibuster rule was adopted. And so what we're talking about here is returning to the Constitution. This is a constitutional option, and having each Senate at the beginning of a Congress vote on the rules. It doesn't mean you throw all the rules out. It doesn't necessarily mean that you make major changes, but you look at what has happened in the past and adopt rules that are going to work for you in the future.
Jim,
I think this is the way out of this box that we're in, which, as Mr. Thurber very well described, is we say the rules continue and it takes 67 votes to change the rules. Well, that's virtually impossible.
Well, the rules can be changed now. That's the rule of the Senate. It's not embedded in the Constitution. And it takes two-thirds of the Senate to change the rules, and you've got to get those votes to do it. And Mr. Reed sounds like he wants to continue with that practice, which is not in the Constitution, but it's not unconstitutional either.
Tom Udall, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. Good luck with your attempt at changing the rules of the Senate.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you this morning. Look forward to continue the debate. You've got some very good commentators on there that are getting to the heart of the issue, I think.
Democrat Tom Udall. He's the junior senator from New Mexico. And joining us now is former Congressman Tom Davis. He served from 1995 to 2008. He was chair of the Republicans' Congressional Campaign Committee from 1998 to 2002. Good morning, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Remind us, why did you leave Congress?
Basically, I just thought I could do better things with my time. It was pretty gridlocked. Our party was in the minority, and there's a time for all things. And I've been a full committee chairman. I've been in the leadership in my 14 years. There's just time to do something else.
Was it dysfunctional?
It was some days it was fun, some it wasn't. But look, Diane, I left undefeated and unindicted, and that's the best way you can go these days. There's a time for all things, and for me, I'd never meant it to be a career. I've been in office 29 years. It was just time to do something else.
Congressman Tom Davis, and you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're looking at the Congress now, as you do, where things are apparently not working very well. The American public is totally dissatisfied, except for a very small portion of the public. Were things always this bad when you served in Congress?
Well, yes and no. Actually, I go back. I was a page up there from 1963 to 1967. Things were very different in those days. The filibuster threshold was 67 then for cloture, but you very rarely filibustered. Now everything is filibustered in the Senate. The House has always been a majority rule body. It was designed that way. It's a little more, it works very fast, very quickly, reacts to the public, and the Senate, as you know, is the saucer that cools it. But having said all that, government seems to work best when both parties have a vested interest in the outcome. And the difficulties we have when one party controls everything, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, is they tend to exclude the other party, who says, okay, you own the outcome, and you get the failure to participate. And that's what we've got now. 60 votes in the Senate, Biden said it. It was almost a curse, because instead of trying to develop some consensus, they went with their base. And, we're where we are at this point. Even the legislation, if it were to pass, would be very unpopular. It's not consensual. It hasn't built, the kind of strong bipartisan majorities that we were capable of doing. And the Republicans have basically nothing to gain and a lot to lose by being complicit in governance at this point.
So, in effect, what you're saying is that Republicans see no need to work with Democrats to get anything done?
Well, Diane, I'd go further than that. It's almost to their detriment. When you map out the midterm elections going back 1966 and on, you'll find that traditionally when one party controls everything and things aren't going well, they take a huge beating at the polls. The exception to that was 1978, when the Republican leadership was complicit with Jimmy Carter in working with him in a bipartisan way on some of the hot-button issues like the Panama Canal. And the end result is a dissatisfied electorate turned on both parties. In 1978, 13 U.S. senators were defeated, 8 Democrats, 5 Republicans. So there was a bipartisan spanking. And I think you sit there as the minority party, you say, it's a bad economy, things aren't going very well. We'll give them ownership. They want their plans. We're not going to get much of a say in policy anyway. And you get a bipartisan government like Clinton had, and you get a balanced budget deal through. You get welfare reform through. You get a lot of things through because both parties have a vested interest in looking good and therefore in the outcome.
I think James Serber wants to make a comment.
I think Congressman Davis is calling for bipartisanship. It's embedded in his discussion. Let's define it. Bipartisanship is a continuing working relationship between the leaders, party committee, and the president from both parties from the very beginning, a place at the table at the very beginning. There are some issues like that on the Hill. Let's don't overstate what's going on. They're not that important, maybe, but education is one of those. National security is one of those. Dealing with debt and deficit, there is a coalition of blue dog fiscal conservatives and Republicans on pay-go, that's pay-as-you-go if you have a tax cut or expenditure. There's some where they agree. We get the news on health care, climate change, cap and trade, where there's no bipartisanship. financial reform. There's no bipartisanship. The president has tried from the second day in office to reach out to the Republican leadership on the stimulus package, meeting with them in the House and the Senate, giving them tax cuts. Remember, two-thirds of that stimulus package are tax cuts, unemployment compensation, and Medicare. He reached out to them. He got zero votes in the House, and he got three in the Senate. So he continues to reach out. The American public like that. They want bipartisanship, but there's nobody at the table on the other side.
Can I make a comment?
Sure. Go ahead, Congressman.
I don't know. I think President Obama's nature may well have been to reach out, but he doesn't control the House. He doesn't control the mechanisms of how these are put together. As you know, this was not coming together as an open rule at all. Republicans weren't allowed to offer amendments. The bill was basically written in the Speaker's office. And if you wanted to deal with them, I guess you could do it in the back room. But although the White House might have done a lot of reaching out, he outsourced a lot of this to the congressional leaders.
All
and
right.
I think that's the result that you end up getting in a situation like that.
Republican Congressman Tom Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Record snowstorms, global warming theories, and the future of climate change talks. An update on where the world stands on limiting greenhouse gas emissions 2 months after the Copenhagen conference. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. And before we open the phones, Chris Eliza, you have an important news piece of news for us.
Yeah, Diane, I just reported on the blog, as you mentioned, The Fix at WashingtonPost.com, that Evan Bayh, the Indiana Democratic senator, is not going to be seeking re-election in 2010. Elected first in 1998 to the Senate, not challenged in any real way between then and now. Republicans had recruited a guy named Dan Coats, a former senator, to run against him. Dan Coats had a very rocky, I think that's being kind, first few weeks in the race. Polls showed Evan Bayh was ahead of Coats by 20 points. Evan Bayh had $13 million in the bank, which is a substantial sum. But he just decided that he was no longer interested in serving. In an excerpt that I got, he mentioned that his desire to serve the public had not waned, but his desire to do so in Congress had.
Why?
I think that might speak to exactly what we're talking about here. A centrist, Evan Bayh, a centrist, feeling as though the Senate was not interested in this sort of deal-making that he could be a major player in, and just decided deciding that at a relatively young age that he was better off stepping aside? The very quickly, the political impact here is significant. This is Indiana is a conservative-leaning state, although the president did win it very narrowly in 2008. This is going to be a very high up on the pickup opportunities for Republicans. We'll see how the two fields shake out. But a major development as it relates to the battle for control in 2010.
Charlie.
Well, Chris is absolutely right. This will be a very, very hard seat for Democrats to hold on to. I'd be surprised if they did. And it starts getting them down to the point where I think we're going to soon start talking about could Democrats really even lose their majority in the Senate. But I think in terms of the why, you know, through up until 2006, we had a Republican Congress and a Republican president, and this town was dysfunctional. And then we had a Democratic Congress and a Republican president for 2 years, and it was dysfunctional. Now we have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and it's dysfunctional. And the town's not working. The place isn't working, and I think Democrats are fearing a horrific election, and a lot of them are bailing out.
Listen here to this email from Carrie in Cincinnati, who says, "I am so despondent, I cannot even get motivated to mail my congressmen or senators anymore. I don't even really want to email into this show. I told all my friends and even emailed this show. In my opinion, Congress was the problem. The only true long-term problem of presidents is Supreme Court nominees. And boy, we're going to live with the results of people in 2004 not realizing this for a long time." Jim Thurber.
Well, I'd like to comment on that indirectly, but on Charlie's comment, and that is, I think dysfunctionality in the House and the Senate is coming by the way they're getting elected. When I first worked in the Senate in 1973, one-third of the Senate were so-called moderates by measuring how they vote. About 5% of the House and the Senate are moderates. Now, the endangered species in Washington is a centrist, and that's a real problem for the president. That's a real problem for the leadership. You've got two wings. They're not able to compromise, not able to come to the middle, and that creates deadlock.
Andy.
Well, the public has a role in this. You know, the public blames Congress and Washington for what's going on. Now, if the public hadn't pushed back as hard against President Obama's expansion of government as many conservatives and some moderates see it, the Republicans could not vote consistently against, and you see that most clearly in health care reform. So the polarization that exists within the public has a role in the polarization that exists here in Washington, despite the fact that the public decries it.
Here's an email from Rick, who says, "My wife and I are disgusted. We worked like dogs to get Obama elected and a Democrat in both Senate seats and our House seat, and they betrayed all of us. The DNC keeps sending me mail wanting more money. Here's my message to them. Not another dime, not another doorbell, not another vote. The Democratic Party must be punished and punished severely for their failures and betrayal of trust." But that's not exactly what your polls are showing, Andy.
No, they're not. But the Democrats are very, very despondent. If there is a major political dynamic that we haven't discussed in terms of where we're going in November, it's that the Republicans are fired up and the Democrats are...
All right, let's go to Larry, who's in Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Actually, the last person's email hit right on what I wanted to say, and that is I am equally despondent, but not at the government, but at the public, particularly the Democrats, as to why they don't direct their anger at the Republican Party for the obstructionist behavior. And when the email, the gentleman said that they sold out, but to me, knowing the mechanism on Capitol Hill and the way our government is structured, there is nothing that they could have done other than completely adopt the Republican platform. in which case that would have been the ultimate compromise. It seems, and in my opinion, from the blogosphere of the Democrats, of which I am, the only solution, and I'll shut up after this, is for Obama, ironically, to push the power of the executive power, in a sort of parallel, roughly, to Franklin Roosevelt.
Charlie.
You know, I've been in Washington for 37 years, watched politics a little longer than that. I have never seen a Democratic president during a economic downturn seen by 60% of Americans, and a Gallup poll is not paying enough attention to the economy. And the thing is, it's been this, they sort of checked the box with an insufficient and undisciplined economic stimulus package, and then quickly moved on to priorities that were near and dear to their hearts, health care and climate change, when the American people have been sending a pretty unmistakable signal for the better part of a year. They wanted the focus on the economy and jobs.
Chris.
And, you know, Diane, earlier we were talking about how the Senate and the House are not necessarily helping the president along, despite being democratically controlled. We saw that last week. Harry Reid, after a bipartisan jobs bill emerged, Harry Reid came out and said, you know what, we're actually not going to do that. We're going to do this more slimmed down bill. It's about the message that it sends. The message that it sends is that they don't seem to have everything together. They're not working as Andy has mentioned. People want bipartisanship. This does not look like bipartisanship to many people who are checking in and then checking out. I think we make the mistake that we think average people are paying as much attention to politics as people like us who are paid to do so on a daily basis. They're not. This doesn't look good, and it clouds the message, which is the Obama administration is focused on jobs and the economy. That should be the message out of the White House every single day, and it's not.
To a certain extent, the public is blaming the Republicans more than the Democrats, but just to a certain extent. And the reason just to a certain extent is over the course of the year, the center of the country, the centrists, the independents, have moved in a conservative direction with regard to government. And that lets the Republicans off the hook.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Kitty.
Yes, Diane, thank you for this show. A couple of your emails, and Andy Kohut made the point that if Congress is the problem, it is the fault of the public and the American people, and I believe that. Politics, however, has become nothing more than another sporting event. These are complex issues that we're dealing with, and people have no time, even if they have an inclination, to be informed thoroughly about the issues. So they are swayed by emotions, and both sides know that. And they hire tacticians to show them the words to use to keep the emotions churned up. So it's all about your team winning. Now, I'm a great football fan, but that's where I want to root for my team. I want my representatives in Congress to deal with complex issues. I need to understand those issues. So the American people have a responsibility to inform themselves, to be informed, and not manipulated.
Charlie.
You know, to Jim's point earlier, I think this is a process issue in the sense that we're getting increasingly ideologues dominating both parties in Congress and just totally out of touch, I think, with most American voters. And, you know, if there were people, we've been so fixated with campaign finance reform, but to be honest, if I could wave a magic wand and do two things, I think it'd be redistricting reform, right, where you would have fewer districts that are designed specifically for a certain party, one party or the other, sometimes for specific people, and the other, I would argue, for to go with open primaries so that an independent voter could make a choice, and they could vote in a Democrat primary or a Republican primary, and I think you'd get more centrist nominees.
Charlie Cook, editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Holiday, Texas. Good morning, Barb. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. I find myself, as I listen to this comment, severely disappointed as I watch in our government the special interests, the extremists, the severe party line delineations that have seemed to have gotten in the way of the ultimate goal, which is a successful America. It seems like the common good is gone by the wayside, and compromise is a thing that just doesn't happen anymore. And I know our previous administration tended to, how do I say this politely, decide that everything had simple answers. They're incredibly complex questions, and I think Obama went in telling us these are complex. We're going to have to work together. What is the way to get our Congress to quit acting like spoiled children? I get this image of children having a temper tantrum.
Jim Thurber.
We define the public interest in this pluralist system, pluralism meaning groups fight with each other by whoever wins among the groups. And we're seeing that clearly with health care, with cap and trade, the climate change thing, and America doesn't like it. But we've struggled from the founding as to what is the public interest. Madison struggled with it when he wrote the Federalist Paper, part of the Federalist Papers. I think we need, as Charlie said, commissions or some other way of drawing districts, because the way you elect people creates these extremes, and the extremes cannot come to the middle in a moderate way and find the public interest. We have 11 states, by the way, that have commissions. We have more competition there. They have in the UK. They have commissions, and they have more competition there, Canada, Australia. It's time to do that. But it's a hopeless cause, because nobody wants to do it if you're an incumbent. The state legislatures control it. And I'm just fearful after 2010 we're going to continue to have these really biased districts.
Chris. You know, the simple, I know it's a simple answer, but the simple answer to the caller's question is, elect different people. I know that that's hard, and I understand that it is not as easy. It's easier said than done, which is the two parties have very strong holds on these things. The establishment tends to still pick the candidate that it would like, give that candidate the money and the resources and the campaign staff and all those sorts of things. But if you continue to elect the same people and be dissatisfied with their performance, the answer is, in the next election, do not elect that person.
But the money is how those people reach the ballot.
That is true, Diane, but I would say that look at Massachusetts. Now, it's a special election. I grant that it's not a typical election. Scott Brown was a state senator who at the end of December had $400,000 in the bank. Martha Coakley was a statewide elected official, a Democrat in a very Democratic state, who had $1.5 or $6 million in the bank. Did Scott Brown eventually raise vast sums of money? Yes, in the very end of the campaign. But I think he built momentum not on fundraising. He built momentum on message that fit, a populist message that fit in with the time. So, yes, money is close to determinative in politics, but it is not entirely determinative, because if it was, Scott Brown would have never gotten started.
Well, and the other thing is that we've got delegations, 50 state delegations, and each one puts their state first. Last week, 2 weeks ago, we saw Senator Shelby from Alabama hold up 70 nominees for presidential nominees for two projects in his home state. The thing is, if the mentality of members of Congress is what happens in my state by definition isn't waste. Spending, if it's in my state, it's good. And you have 50 states, 435 congressmen doing that, and the national interest comes in pretty damn low on the list.
All right, let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi there, Patricia, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that the way out of the box is that we just need to impose term limits, perhaps maybe a six-year term limit of getting them in, working for actually the United States, and not listening to lobbyists. Because with the new Supreme Court decision, the companies are able to funnel as much money as they can. The average American, we're sunk. We're never going to know who the real person is.
What do you think, Jim Thurber?
We have term limits. They're called elections. I want better elections by having better districts drawn, so at least 100 districts are competitive. Last time we had 65 a few years ago. We had 26 seats in the House that were competitive, where people won by 55% or less. If you have term limits, you give more power to vested interests and lobbyists and the bureaucracy and the staff on the Hill, and I'd rather give that power to an elected public official.
And Diane, just quickly to back up Jim's point, look at California. That's a perfect example of why term limits are not the answer. You have a government in which the lobbyists and the public, the special interests control everything, because they have the institutional wisdom as opposed to the legislators.
Charlie,
that's absolutely right.
Considering the situation on the Hill right now, should President Obama move forward in the way one of our earlier callers suggested, riding roughshod over the Congress? Is there a way to do that and get things done that need to be done?
I think the problem is he should have done that from the beginning. Now he's trying to get – the horses are already out of the corral. Nobody on Capitol Hill is afraid of President Obama anymore. He had the high ground back in January, February, March. He lost it. They don't fear him. A lot of them don't even respect him anymore.
I think he overlearned the lesson of 1994, where he didn't, where Clinton in the healthcare reform didn't talk to the chairs. They had the answer. They went forward, and they got rolled on the Hill. He gave too much power to Henry Waxman. He gave too much power to the chairs in the stimulus, healthcare, and cap and trade, and it's hurt him.
I would end by saying one thing to our esteemed guests. It's only 1 year into President Obama's term. You never know. Thanks for being here, everybody. James Thurber of the American University, Charlie Cook of the Cook Political Report, Chris Haliza, author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.